I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On Friday of last week, Justice Anthony Kennedy, in speaking for the majority of the Supreme Court in regards to same-sex marriage, said, "No longer may this liberty be denied. No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. Marriage is a keystone of our social order, and the plaintiffs in the case were seeking equal dignity in the eyes of the law." Chief Justice John Roberts, in dissent, said the Constitution had nothing to say on the subject of same-sex marriage. If you're among the many Americans of whatever sexual orientation who favor expanding same-sex marriage, by all means, celebrate today's decision. Celebrate the achievement of a desired goal. Celebrate the opportunity for a new expression of commitment to a partner. But do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it. The historic ruling by the Supreme Court, 5-4 decision last Friday, is what we talk about this hour of the program, and we have two guests with us. Professor Gwen Leachman is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and a faculty affiliate with the Sociology Department at the university. She teaches courses in labor relations, employment discrimination, and sexual orientation and gender identity law. And later in the hour, Mark Solomon will be with us, National Campaign Director for Freedom to Marry, who led the campaign in Massachusetts and played leading roles in New York, Illinois, California, Washington, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Maine. He's been doing this work for a number of years, so Friday must have been quite an extraordinary day for him. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we entertain your thoughts about how the Supreme Court ruled last week. And we also heard during the news here just a few moments ago from NPR that there is some pushback against the law with Alabama deciding not to honor same-sex marriages. And I guess there's a hold on them for at least the next 25 days. Will we see more such attempts by states? We'll cover that. But first, we welcome our first guest to be with us, Professor Leachman. Thank you very much for being with us. Hello. Oh, Professor Leachman, are you there? Well, we'll just try and reach her again. Let me give you our phone number, because I would imagine that you'll have a lot to say about last week's ruling. It was a big, big ruling. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we would like to hear your comments as well. We're also on Twitter, and that is @KDunnShow. Professor Leachman, here we go. I think you're with us now. Hi, Professor Leachman.
Hi.
Okay.
On the line.
Hey, there we go. Hi, Professor Leachman. Thank you very, very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, there were a lot of big parades all over the country yesterday, weren't there? But there are people who are upset about this, but there are many, many more people who have worked for many years to see this Supreme Court decision take place, haven't they?
That's right. I mean, this is actually something that, although it has kind of popped into the popular consciousness fairly recently, this is something that has been the work of activists in the LGBT movement and their allies for decades now. So this is something that a lot of people have worked hard for, and the praise is worthwhile, right? I mean, they deserve that.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to hear what the Chief Justice Kennedy, who's given the majority opinion in several gay rights cases in the last 12 years or so. I was reading that he says that he would embrace a vision of a living constitution that evolves with societal changes. He has said the nature of injustice is that we may not always see it in our own times, versus what Justice Roberts said, that go ahead and celebrate this. You can do things you couldn't do before, but let me tell you, the Constitution didn't grant you that right. It seems to me as though it's two very, very different views on how you legislate, how you reach a decision or don't reach a decision.
Right. Well, yes, the idea of a living constitution versus a stagnant constitution, as some might call it, is something that's been a debate between the conservative and more progressive justices on the Supreme Court for a long time. But this is actually you know, more specifically about how to define what they call a fundamental right to marriage under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And that is, you know, in terms, so marriage has been recognized as a fundamental right in previous decisions, and in those decisions, what the majority opinion rightly notes is that marriage has always been considered in its broadest possible terms when that analysis is occurring. Right, you don't define marriage based on who has been able to participate in that institution in the past. In fact, that would have made interracial marriages still illegal, right? So the idea here is that you're not, regardless of whether you think about the Constitution as a living Constitution, previous precedent has held that, you know, marriage should be considered as in terms of how it is, what's its relationship to society, and what role does it have for individuals, rather than in today's society, rather than who has been able to engage in the institution in the past.
Mm-hmm. The Justice Kennedy also made mention of couples raising children and how important it was for stability, for predictability, for recognition that marriage offers all of that. And if children in those marriages don't have a marriage, that they suffer from it.
Yeah, and that was very important for the LGBT activists to hear because, for example, this is one of the areas that that LGBT activists were concerned was going to be a place of rollback, that states were going to continue to cut away in areas of adoption or not fully recognizing spouses who are legally married but happen to be same-sex spouses. So there have been, for example, in Iowa, there was a lesbian couple who had a child, and the state officials decided not to put the non-biological mother on that child's birth certificate, even though there's this presumption in Iowa that the spouse of the person who is having the baby is supposed to be presumed to be the parent of that child. So that was one of the areas where, you know, how well, even if we are given protections for marriage, how well is this going to be able to actually protect our children when there are significant decisions to, you know, try to roll this back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but in the end, that said, you know, the majority opinion in Obergefell, I mean, it was very clear that it was based on the fact that it's very important to the court that to preserve the not only the, you know, the economic security of children born in same-sex couple relationships, but also to, you know, to protect really them against stigma, the stigma that's afforded when their parents are not able to be entitled to the same rights and privileges as their peers.
Tell us, we'll talk about this a little more with Mark, but the story of Jim Obergefell, who lost his husband in 2013, died of this horrible ALS decision, that he was prompted, I mean, love is so much a part of all of this. He said, the love I have for him is worth fighting for, and I do and I will, to the Supreme Court, he said, and beyond. If that isn't a marriage, I don't know what it is, when their marriage, which was out of Ohio, was not recognized by the state of Ohio, and he wanted his name to be on the death certificate. So he fought for this, and little did he know it would go all the way to the Supreme Court. There have to be tens of thousands of cases similar to this or slightly different all over the country, Professor.
Right, and, you know, this is not just, you know, a narrative of a couple's marriage-like relationship. This is really a couple that has gone far, far beyond what we often see in marital relationships, right? I mean, this is actually the idealized version of marriage. And, of course, you know, this is exactly the sort of person that you do want to have as a plaintiff for these sorts of cases. But it's unfortunate that such perseverance, such enormous strength that these plaintiffs have, and the journeys that they've gone on just to secure these basic rights, is something that actually goes beyond what a lot of real life marriages look like. It's important to keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm. We are now reading a lot about discrimination, everyday life problems, being able to get a job and not getting fired, being able to rent or get a home and not being told that you can't have this discrimination because you may be gay. I'm wondering about the need in this country to get rid of all of those forms, and there are many of them, of discrimination.
Right. So that's something that actually a lot of people in the movement are very excited to turn back to be looking at these more sort of basic, essential issues that affect people's daily lives. In a way that's even maybe more essential than marriage. You know, marriage has taken off in the public's mind. It has, just cycled on and has become an issue of its own. And it's actually startling for a lot of people in the movement who are wondering, how did employment discrimination get derailed as one of our major objectives? And so now what a lot of people are really thinking is, well, good, it's time to turn back and it's time to look at these more immediate concerns that are facing a lot more of the, neediest segments of the LGBT community, honestly. So things like employment discrimination. I mean, this is an area that is desperately in need of some major activism, right? So there's between 15 and 43% of LGBT workers, and this is Williams Institute, the UCLA Williams Institute statistics, have been fired or denied promotions or harassed because of their sexuality or gender identity. I mean, these are huge numbers.
Yes, they are.
Been discriminated against. And really, the patchwork of legal protections that are available to them is meager and only really affects about half of the U.S. workforce. So this is definitely an area where the focus should be looking forward.
So what's the remedy for that?
Well, there's the remedy that's been proposed, tried. There's a longstanding effort to get federal legislation passed like Title VII. So backing up for a second, something that most of Americans are actually not aware of is that Title VII does not protect against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, meaning if you are fired from your job because you are lesbian, gay, or bisexual, you are not entitled to protection under Title VII, Title VII being the major anti-discrimination law that most people would refer to at the federal level. For the past two decades, advocates have been proposing over and over again legislation called the Enforcement Non-Discrimination Act, which is supposed to protect people for discrimination based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, again, filling in the gaps of where Title VII does not provide coverage. That has not worked so far, and there's little hope that it's going to kind of work in the current political setting with majority Republicans. But at the same time, people are now starting to see that, okay, well, what happened with Obergefell? There's such an incongruity now between the advances that we've seen in marriage mm-hmm. and the advances that we've seen in employment, which is, frankly, an area where more Americans, even than the majority of those who now support same-sex marriage, more actually support equal employment opportunities for LGBT people. So we should really see some changes starting to happen here. We'll be looking forward to that.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest the first half hour is Professor Gwen Leachman, professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and also faculty affiliate with the sociology department. We're talking about last Friday's Supreme Court ruling, major ruling on same-sex marriage, and asking what your thoughts are about it. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, love to have your messages put down there so we can read them, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we're going to take a look at online dating. Our guest is NYU sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, who recently teamed up with a comedian for a new book, Modern Romance, an Investigation, which offers a funny and research-driven look at online dating. should be a good show, fun show tomorrow. All right, let's go to phone calls and messages. Professor Gwen Leachman and Ali, is it? Ali in Madison? How do you pronounce your name? Hello?
Oh, hello. Yes?
Yes. Ali. Hi, Ali. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. So I just want to ask, and before I ask, I would preface that I'm a gay man. And I actually was a little disappointed with the decision on Friday with the Supreme Court, mostly in the sense that it had to be a decision the Supreme Court made about the ethics of allowing gay marriage to be recognized, because I know marriage in itself as a religious institution has a long history, but it seems recently it's been merged into the secular field and to the legal field. And it seems like it would have been better had marriage stayed as a religious institution and allow religious institutions to do as they wish. And there are a lot of liberal religious institutions, even in the conservative religions, that do accept gay marriage, and then have the legal status of marriage affords be kind of kept in civil unions, and have the issue kind of separated like that. And I can take my comments off air.
All right. Thanks, Ali.
Yeah. Yes, it was very much the sort of decision that the Supreme Court was expected to make. But in terms of the idea that let me explain why it was such a decision that we were sort of expecting. It was one of these. So Kennedy has been really praised for the kind of even poetic sort of lauding that he did of marriage in this decision, and talking about the dignity of the same-sex couples who would like to enter this institution of marriage. What happens in this decision is you see this stressing of the idea that, you know, far from seeking to devalue marriage, I'm quoting the majority opinion, the petitioners are asking, the petitioners seek it for themselves because of their respect for the institution. It was very much about reframing this previously contentious issue about whether or not same-sex couples were going to, you know, bring the institution on its head, right? And actually saying, no, what same-sex couples are doing is really preserving marriage as an important social force. So yes, it was very much preservationist about marriage as a state-sponsored institution, and the importance of it in, you know, as Kennedy actually said, you know, it's being a keystone of our social order. So continuing this state marriage focus, and there are some in the LGBT movement and beyond, and we've seen it a lot in Europe, that want the state to be out of the business. Now, there are some ironies that are developing with that in terms of people protesting the decision by actually pulling their states out of the marriage business. But we can talk more about that later.
Andy on email has two questions for you. One, do you have any thoughts on the court not extending protected class status to LGBT individuals? And two, any thoughts on states, individuals claiming First Amendment protection from same-sex marriage? What are the parallels between the race civil rights movement, if any?
Right. So yes, there were many roads that were not taken in the court's focus on the fundamental right to marry. What we lost out of was really a more concerted focus on this, the kind of traditional equal protection analysis that the court has used in the past, has been moving away from recently, but that has really been a central focus for past decisions. So what have we lost in terms of not finding sexual orientation to be a protective class? Well, you know, yes, that's never before been explicitly given a higher level of scrutiny. Sexual orientation has never specifically been identified as a protected class. So, you know, that makes that continues with the array of lower federal court decisions, finding all over the map in terms of whether or not, you know, is it sexual orientation that should be given heightened scrutiny? Is it that we should look at these things as sex discrimination? And this is all spills over into how the court is going to look at other sorts of regulations, laws that are affecting LGBT people. So the focus on marriage, in short, makes it a little bit less of an easy translation from this decision to other areas of LGBT rights.
Interesting.
So the second question I believe, about the state
claiming
factors.
Mm-hmm. Claiming First Amendment protection from a same-sex marriage. What are the parallels between the race civil rights movement, if any?
Well, in terms of the protections given to marriage, the decision did draw a lot on this 1967 decision, which is the Loving decision, which found that prohibitions on interracial intimacy are unconstitutional. In that, it did focus on this idea of the fundamental right to marriage not being able to be denied to interracial couples in that context, and here extending that same logic to same-sex couples. Is that more or less what the question
yes.
was? Okay, yeah. And so in terms of the state actors having First Amendment protections, what I believe that question might be referring to is the sort of backlash that we're seeing in the variety of religious freedom laws that are trying mm-hmm. to kind of thwart the implementation of the decision through various means. And I can go through the different types that I've seen crop up. But this one sounds like it's talking specifically to places like North Carolina that has passed a law that says that, that allows public employees to refuse to participate in the steps that are needed to make a marriage valid, right, based on any sincerely held religious exemption.
Yes.
So this raises constitutional issues because there's state action here, right? There's it raises the issues that as to whether or not, these state employees are actually impinging upon the right that the court has now found that same-sex couples have the right to marry. So it's really, it is unclear how these things are going to play out in the courts. There will certainly be litigation. The Texas Attorney General also said that, that it would protect employees that, refused based on religious objections to make same-sex marriage valid in that state. So undoubtedly we'll see litigation, constitutionality of those sorts of actions. It's unclear, especially when you look at the abortion context, which basically the court has said yes, there's a right to abortion, but there's all these indirect ways that you can sort of practically take that right away from women a lot of times by making it very difficult for women to receive an abortion. So similarly here, these rights are sort of making it difficult, right? You go to one clerk and they say no, religious exemption. You go to another clerk, right? It just adds another layer to your ability as a same-sex couple to exercise your rights.
And we go to Bill in Eau Claire next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kathleen. My question has to do with a term. I'm wondering what will happen to the term domestic partner as far as the legality, workers' benefits, et cetera, and I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Bill.
Right. So usually what you see, so domestic partner is a term that some states who have not wanted marriage have used to kind of afford either some of the rights of marriage or all of the rights of marriage, for example, to same-sex couples. And those, what generally happens when states have actually allowed for same-sex marriages to take place in their states is the domestic partner laws lose relevance. Domestic partnership laws don't apply to, in a lot of states, anybody but same-sex couples. So opposite-sex couples, for example, in California, could not, under their domestic partnership law, enter into a domestic partnership. So the purpose of the law has sort of faded away. So what happens to those laws? I mean, I would expect the same thing to happen here.
And thank you very much for your call. And we want to thank you so much. Just your overall thoughts about the historic nature of this. I mean, the president, who's been on a roll lately, talked about it in terms of forming a more perfect union, which I thought was a perfectly apt choice of words for this and a beautiful choice of words for it. It's a very large deal in the country, isn't it? When I look at big things that have happened in my lifetime, this is one of them.
Yeah, I think we're all going to kind of think of it in terms of where were you when you heard the decision came down. It is one of those major moments, and a lot of people are comparing it to, the Brown versus Board of Education decision. At the same time, what I'm a bit wary of is that, like the Brown versus Board of Education decision, I'm worried about seeing the same sort of foot dragging that happened in that context as well. I mean, if you remember the Southern strategy
right.
to resist desegregation attempts by the federal government, it happened over and over again. And so, my worry is that people are going to see this as a symbolic victory and kind of rest on their laurels and at the same time, you know, be blindsided to the numerous ways in which states can actually thwart same-sex couples' ability to effectively exercise the rights that they've now been given.
Which is already happening today in Alabama, where they will not perform same-sex marriages for at least 25 days.
Yes. Well, that I'm less worried about that in particular because there is actually a 25-day time period that happens before the Supreme Court, you know, issues the, quote, mandate, you know, the official copy of its decision. So that's not very shocking. I mean, that's the least amount of foot-dragging you can do. I'm more worried about, you know, the other sorts of the religious freedom laws that are popping up and making it, businesses unable to cater to, or making it possible for businesses to refuse services to LGBT couples, although they may be, you know, public accommodations. That's more what I think will have a bigger impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you ever so much for being with us, Professor Gwen Leachman. Thanks. Professor Gwen Leachman, a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, faculty affiliate with the Sociology Department at the University of Wisconsin, and she has done a lot of work on how litigation has affected the LGBT movement, including the dynamics among LGBT movement organizations, public perceptions of the movement, and the compatibility of the mainstream movement's goals with the more underrepresented segments of the LGBT community. We turn now to our second guest of the hour, and he was with us, I don't know, it seems like yesterday. I'm sure it wasn't because it was April. Thanks, KP. It was April? Yeah. Because he was the author of Winning Marriage, the inside story of how same-sex couples took on the politicians and pundits and won. And they really won on Friday, even though there will be a struggle ahead, as we heard from Professor Leachman. This was a major victory. Mark, National Campaign Director for Freedom to Marry, a nonprofit advocacy organization founded in 2003 and campaigned for the right of same-sex couples to marry in the U.S. And Mark led campaigns in Massachusetts, played leading roles in New York, Illinois, California, Washington, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Maine. The book really outlines how Friday was able to happen. It just wasn't willy-nilly. It was the result of decades and decades of very carefully planned strategy and lots of work on the part of many people who were committed to having this happen. Mark, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, well, I bet you're really good.
I'm great.
I'll bet you are. So tell me about Friday. Where were you? Were you with a group of people? How did you listen? What did you think right away?
Sure. So I was in our office with Evan Wolfson, who was really the Daily Beast calls him the godfather of gay marriage. He's been at it for 32 years.
Wow.
A whole office full of people. We were all sitting around our computers and watching the Twitter feed, and that's how we got the news. And it was really a it was an exceedingly powerful day. And it's I've felt like I've been floating ever since.
You say in your book, Mark, that you're very mindful of the fact that you were leading a movement and you had already really joined a movement that was years in the making, beginning in earnest with the court victories in Hawaii in the 1990s. And this went on before that, too. This was a decision that was years in the making and very carefully strategized, wasn't it?
Yeah, no question about it. It's people like Evan, who I just mentioned, and then Mary Bonato, who's driven the legal strategy. She argued the case before the Supreme Court. Have been at this for a very long time, and the fact I think for a lot of your listeners, and a lot of people are saying to me, you know, this happened overnight, it happened so quickly, but, and it's true that many states have come on board over the last couple of years, but the, you know, the movement, the public education, and the, you know, the sort of really deep work to win our first round of states and hold on to them and then add more and grow public support, that's happened over the course of decades.
Mm. And when it comes to the Supreme Court, do you very carefully analyze what they've said before on this issue? Do you try to work up strategies that will play to what their natural inclinations might be? How do you approach the Supreme Court on this?
Sure. So with the Supreme Court, I mean, big picture, our strategy has always been that in order to win nationwide, the Supreme Court would need to act. But at the same time, we also, analyzing history, we knew that the Supreme Court would be the last, you know, it would act after we'd done a sufficient amount of work to show that the country was ready for national resolution. So before we wanted to have a case go to the U.S. Supreme Court, we wanted to win a critical mass of states and grow public support to a critical mass. And we did that. And, when the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, we were at 37 states. We were at 60 to 65% public support nationwide. And that's when we thought that we could get the court to rule our way. In addition, no question that some of the arguments and some of the friend of the court briefs were tailored to individual justices. We knew that we needed, you know, justices, you know, certainly we needed Anthony Kennedy to come our way. And so, we looked for, we highlighted Republican support. We highlighted the support of, 300 plus mainstream American businesses, et cetera.
So. Mm-hmm. It was long. It was very hard, very productive work from our lengthy conversation when the book came out. You worked really hard on this, Mark. So many people did.
Yeah, I did work hard, and so many people worked hard. So many of your listeners worked hard to fight, you know, against the constitutional amendment in Wisconsin, and then that of course didn't, we didn't win on that. But, you know, people have been making the case on marriage for a couple decades very actively, and it's because people, including myself, are so inspired by the notion of, you know, of having the freedom to get married as a same-sex couple.
And why all the work on marriage? Why not work on discrimination in the workplace, discrimination in trying to get a house? Obviously, those are issues, and we need some kind of protection in law for that, or maybe another Supreme Court case to afford people in the LGBT community those same kind of rights. Why not push that way instead of marriage?
Well, for me personally, marriage resonated in a very strong way. I think for me, and I think for a lot of Americans, culturally, it's really a rite of passage in our society to be able to marry. And if you're denied the ability to marry, if the government says that your relationship, we're going to treat you as a legal stranger, that has a stigma that is a powerfully negative one for an oppressed, a community that's gone through a lot. So I thought the marriage conversation was and winning marriage was crucial. I also think that the conversation around marriage and highlighting same-sex couples and the depth of their relationship and the fact that so many live in local communities all over the place has, it really advances the ball a long way in educating people about who we are, which will help get other laws passed.
Mm-hmm. We were talking with our earlier guest about Justice Kennedy's comments concerning children, which I thought were important, and it was important, I think, for everybody to hear the decision include recognition of the children of same-sex marriage or before same-sex marriage who face a stigma of knowing that their families are, as the justice said, somehow lesser.
Yeah, that's no question about that. And, you know, one of the super powerful plaintiffs in this case was a couple from the state across the lake from you all in Michigan. And they, you know, they had adopted, these two women had adopted four foster kids. And actually, in fact, they'd each adopted two foster kids because they weren't, you know, the only way they could jointly adopt the kids is if they were married and the state wouldn't marry them. So, you know, that to me just, you know, sort of epitomizes the crucial nature of marriage to, you know, to couples who are raising children. And, you know, certainly Justice Kennedy spoke of the importance of getting rid of the stigma for those kids, as well as making sure that those kids can be fully protected.
And tell me about how many plaintiffs were there in this case, Mark?
That's a good question. I can't remember at the moment. There were four states, and there were multiple plaintiffs from several of the states. So it was a big crew of folks.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls from Mark, and here's how you reach our conversation. We have several Facebook messages we want to read to him. Mark Solomon is our guest for this part of the show. We spoke with Mark, anticipating there would be a ruling. We didn't know when, but we talked to him in April when his book came out, Winning Marriage, The Inside Story of How Same-Sex Couples Took on the Politicians and Pundits and Won, with an ultimate victory when it comes to marriage on Friday. Mark, National Campaign Director for Freedom to Marry. He directs programs and has To Win Marriage Nationwide. So we need to put that on the cover of the book now. It needs an update. He's worked on this for 13 years and led campaigns to protect marriage in Massachusetts. He worked hard also in New York, Illinois, California, Washington, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Maine, and other places. Here's our phone number. What do you make of the ruling? A big historic ruling it was. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Of course, not everybody was happy with this decision, and there are some Republican candidates to a person, I think they disagreed with this, some calling for a constitutional amendment. Does Mark worry about that at all? What does he think? You have to believe that there will be some kind of backlash against a decision that is this enormous. So we will talk about that and talk to you in a minute. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have several messages on Facebook, Mark. Let's read them and then get your response. Rose says, the issue never mattered to me. I always wonder what inspires some to want to rule the private lives of others. Jim says it was four votes short and about 225 years late, otherwise a good day for the last Friday in June. And Dawn says marriage has always been and always will be what God defined it to be in the Bible. And she quotes Matthew 19, and he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Respond to each of those, or none of those, or all of those?
Well, I think you know, on the first you know, the first ones, I think you know, the notion of freedom and being able to be left alone has been a powerful message that I think resonates with a lot of Americans. That, you know, why should the government be sort of telling people who it's appropriate that they live their life with. And secondly, you know, I of course would love for this to have happened a couple hundred years ago. But happy enough that it happened, you know, that we've reached this day on Friday. And, you know, I'd say that, you know, with respect to the third message, you know, many, many Americans, you know, we're talking about a civil marriage license, not a religious
right.
marriage ceremony, and there's nothing in this decision that requires any religious denomination to perform any marriage that isn't in sync with the tenets of that religion.
Adam in Madison, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, madam. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Great.
I just called to say just how overjoyed I am with the ruling. It's brought me to tears since I heard it, and I'm just really excited that not only can everyone now experience marriage, but they also get all the protections that come along with that, legal and financial and familial. So that's all I had to say. I'm really happy that my kids get to grow up in this world.
Hmm. Thank you, Adam, so much. And what a difference. It does make a difference in growing up for the lives of children. When you think about where you were when you were a young person and a teenager, Mark, if marriage had been, same-sex marriage had been the law of the land, I'll bet your life would have been a little different, don't you?
I do. And I think, for me personally, that is the most profound implication of the ruling is for, I think it's for America at large, But I think about the young LGBT people who grew up, when I grew up, and there was just such a strong notion that there was something wrong with being gay. And I think now that through this decision, America is really treating same-sex couples and treating gay people as full equals. It just sends such a powerful message
yes.
All over the place. And it's really, it's really wonderful to be able to think about that.
Mm-hmm. What backlash do you expect? What are you prepared for?
Honestly, I think it's going to be a lot less than some people predict. We now had marriage before the ruling in 37 states. And if you looked at some of the most conservative states in the country, states like Utah and Oklahoma, this notion of backlash just really hasn't materialized very, very much. I think it's because it doesn't affect, for the vast majority of people in the state, it doesn't personally affect them. And even if people who are, even for people who aren't with us, most people just don't sort of notice it unless you're hanging out at the courthouse or something all day long. And then, then the other thing is that there's so much joy and so much happiness. And
mm-hmm.
I think, what we've seen is that support in the states that have adopted marriage not only continues to grow, but it accelerates as people, see couples who are committed to one another and who are getting married. So I expect, as we've seen, that some politicians will demagogue the issue a little bit, but when it comes to practical implications, I have a lot of confidence that things will go smoothly.
So you don't worry about a constitutional amendment?
I don't, honestly. I really don't. I think America is really beyond that. I bet if you were to poll whether people would be support a constitutional amendment to take it away, it would be way down in the
mm-hmm.
In the 20% or something like that. So I think it's I don't think that will get any will have any energy behind it.
Adam, thanks so much for your call. Michael in Cambridge, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
As a clergy person, I first of all, when people say about the biblical pattern of marriage, I cringe a little because there's many different patterns and examples of marriage, many of them not monogamous in the Bible. But more to the point of the conversation, I'm curious about if we're ever going to move more toward the European model where we see marriage, and one of the callers last half hour mentioned this, but in the reverse way. Is marriage more legal or is it more religious? And in Europe, most of the countries, you go to the courthouse and you're married, and then you go to the church for the blessing. Because it is. I find myself in an awkward position as a clergy person, having to be a functionary of the state in performing weddings, because I have to fill out forms for the state in a very meticulous way with black ink, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm a functionary of the state. And where's the separation there? So anyway, I'd favor, and I think many of my colleagues would favor, having people married at the courthouse and then come to the church for the blessing.
Mark.
Yeah, I certainly don't have a problem with that. I think, though, that the way we have done it for a long time is with respect to clergy being agents of the state with respect to marriage, you know, is going to continue. I don't see a real effort to try to, I don't know who would sort of drive hard an effort to try to take that, you know, remove that. So I wouldn't expect it to change. But I think it is really important that people continue to recognize that marriage, you know, even if your marriage is performed by a clergy person, they are acting both as an agent of the state in many cases, as well as an agent of the faith tradition.
Thanks, Michael. Aaron in Minnesota. Hi.
Hey. Yeah, you earlier you said everybody's happy about this fishing wall. I don't think everybody's happy about it, including me. I believe in the Bible, and the Bible is strongly against this, and quite frankly, it makes me sick how far we've turned from God on this whole issue. Nobody recognizes God in this thing. It's all about, it's all about happiness and joy and whatever. I guess it comes down to what you call joy, but it's...
Thanks very much, Aaron, for your call. I don't think God has any problem with happiness and joy. Do you, Mark?
Well, I think that no, of course I don't.
Right.
But I think that what a lot of people of faith are doing as they really examine what's most crucial to them about their faith is that they come to a notion of the golden rule of treating others the way that they want to be treated, and that's what's led so many people of faith and so many mainstream denominations, like the Episcopalians, Presbyterians, et cetera, to embrace the freedom to marry. I hope the caller and, you know, and other people of faith, you know, really think about what it is that is, that is so powerful to them about their faith, and look at that question of treating your neighbor as you want to be treated.
Mm-hmm. Well, our thoughts about things kind of change sometimes, too. And he's not the Chief Justice. Justice Kennedy, who gave the majority, talked about, I mentioned this before, he made mention of the nature of injustice is that we may not always see it in our own times, you know, and maybe it's something that everybody will live into. Maybe religions will live into it at some point as well, because there was religious opposition to interracial marriage. We sometimes have to live through issues. Do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think that have experienced so much change in mainstream denominations over the course of this last decade.
Yes.
When I was first involved in this, it was really the Unitarians,
right,
and Reformed Jews, and, you know, the sort of the real, you know, the most liberal denominations.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's mainstream. Plenty of mainstream denominations are with us on it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Aaron, for the call. Two more quick calls. We need to do it in a minute. Brian from Fond du Lac.
Hey, how you doing? First of all, congratulations on all your hard work. As a straight middle-aged male, I have many, many friends who appreciate very much what you've done and had the opportunity now to marry. And I have two points I want to make.
It's got to be one. We're almost out of time, Brian.
Okay. All right. Let it go then.
Oh, okay. No, you can say one.
Oh, okay. All right. Sure.
Okay.
First of all, Ted Cruz is coming forward with quite a few announcements about how unelected lawyers are able to interpret the Constitution and how unfair it is. I thought that was good for a humorous jolt for the day. In other words, the third part of the government is completely illegitimate. I thought it was pretty hilarious for him to say that, considering he's supposed to be a well-educated man.
Thank you very much, Brian, for your call. And thank you, Mark, again for joining us. You just need to take a week off and take it all in, sir. You need a vacation, don't you think?
I'm ready for vacation, but I am exceedingly happy and very grateful.
Mark Solomon, our guest, his book is Winning Marriage, The Inside Story of How Same-Sex Couples Took on the Politicians and Pundits and Won. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Scott Myers for producing this hour. And thank you for your calls and your interest. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.